Okay, we talked about voltammetry. We finished up our discussion of potentiometry. Very simple, straightforward, easy to understand, electroanalytical techniques. So potentiometry, whether we're talking about pH measurements, ion selective electrode measurements, whatever it is, it falls under the idea or the principle of making a potential measurement and based on the Nernst equation, determining what the concentrations are. We covered all that. We talked about the reference electrode, indicator electrodes, and so forth. Now we've moved on to this other area of electrochemistry, voltammetry. It involves a different principle of operation, and it is not, the Nernst equation is still going to apply, and we're going to use the Nernst equation, but here, the typical mode of operation is to apply a potential, apply a voltage to a system, not wait for the voltage to develop in a galvanic cell as in potentiometry, but here an electrolytic cell, electrolyze the solution, apply this potential, and cause an oxidation or reduction reaction to occur depending on that potential, and we will then measure the current that flows in the system as the oxidized species is converted to the reduced species, or the reduced species is converted to an oxidized species, whatever is going on there. That's basically the idea of voltammetry. Now, there's going to be a few variations. As a matter of fact, there's going to be 14 variations. But relax, we'll take care of it. Okay? An electrochemical cell with basically two half cells. It is an electrolytic system. We're going to apply a potential. We could apply a current and measure the potential, but that's a very rare permutation of this kind of electrochemistry. And we are causing an oxidation reduction reaction. I'm just looking at my notes here and looking at some of the key words. It does occur. The reaction occurs at the surface of the electrode. It's right at that interface between that solid electrode. Actually, it could be a liquid electrode. Yeah, a mercury. It could be a mercury electrode. Or most of the time it's a solid electrode, gold, platinum, carbon of some form. And the reaction is going to occur between a species in solution and the electrode surface. We'll talk initially about two electrode systems. I won't get to three electrode systems until maybe next class. I don't know. A couple of classes. We started talking about mass transport, and so stirred or unstirred is going to make a difference. Typically, we measure the current in the system when we apply a potential. Those are connected. Or if we apply a current, we measure the voltage, but we'll worry about that later on. I did mention to you that the rate at which the oxidation and reduction reaction occurs is determined by two things, and that is the mass transport and the electrode kinetics. So, a rate of reaction. We understand the rates of reactions typically in chemistry, and in this case we're measuring usually current. Current is the flux of electrons flowing in a electrical system. Okay, so the amount of material that is being oxidized or reduced, creating a current, is going to give rise to some flux of electrons. And it's basically Faraday's law. We'll get into that later on a little bit. But the idea is how much current we measure is dependent on how much of the species is being converted, ox to red, red to ox. And that is dependent on the rate at which we get material to the electrode surface for it to react, and the intrinsic kinetics of the system, how fast the reaction occurs. Now, the kinetics is something that we don't have much control over, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, although you can find in the literature a rigorous mathematical description of the kinetics in electrochemical processes. Electrode kinetics, I'm not sure yet. It's actually mentioned. Yeah, electrode kinetics. It's in blue. How could I miss it? Is described mathematically, but we don't have much control over it, and the math is pretty hairy. So I'm not going to get into it at all. We're stuck with it. whatever the system is, you said, I have to measure X, well then, you're kind of stuck with what X is able to do electrochemically. You can change your electrode material, but that's not going to make a huge difference. It'll make some difference, but not a huge difference. You can change the temperature, because things happen faster at higher temperatures. However, you don't have a big range over which you're going to be able to change that temperature. We don't do electrochemistry at typically at highly elevated temperatures. You know, you might warm it up to 40 degrees C. You know, that might be a high temperature for electrochemistry, typically. And you might cool it down to 4 degrees C, but generally speaking, we do things at room temperature. So we're kind of stuck with this whole kinetic deal. Nature of the reaction, that's what you need to measure. Electrode surface, well, we could change the electrode or polish it or do some things to it, but it's not going to make a big difference. The temperature, narrow range. So we're not going to deal with that too much. I'll come back to it in a minute after I review the mass transport stuff and add a little bit to it, I guess. I said last time, when it comes to this area of mass transport, rate, amount of current is going to depend on how fast we can get stuff to the electrode surface to react. We do not want it to migrate the three modes of mass transport I mentioned, migration, diffusion, and convection. I didn't really talk about convection, did I? I probably just talked about migration and diffusion. We were talking about Fick's laws. Well, migration is the bad one. We don't want migration. No migration, okay? That's for electrophoresis and conductivity measurements, yes?
Why is it?
Well, one of the reasons is we cannot readily predict it. In other words, if you give me, the boss comes to me and says, here's some solutions. I need you to measure something in these solutions. And I go, oh, okay. First question, as an analytical chemist, you got to ask a lot of questions, okay? So what do you want me to measure, and what's the concentration range, and what's the matrix, okay? So if you give me a distilled water sample, and a seawater sample, and a urine sample, and, I don't know, a wastewater sample, okay, the matrix is very different. When I go to do electrochemistry, the migration, and let's say I'm measuring copper, okay, and the copper is easily measured, and it's they're all at similar concentrations, and there's no problem with the analyte, but there's a problem with the matrix. The amount of migration that would occur in those solutions is going to be different because of their matrix components, primarily the salt content. It changes. Now, you say, well, maybe we could normalize the matrix. It's going to be tough because the seawater is loaded with salt. So I would have to make all of the other samples have an equal amount of salt or an equal matrix into which or in which the analyte ion, the copper, would migrate the same extent. Because if it migrates differently, it's going to get to the electrode faster or slower, and I'm going to get a different response, and I'm not going to be able to compare the measurement to anything that I know. Does that make sense?
So the other thing
they interfere in a very indirect way. Okay, they don't cause a response. What they do is they cause the analyte of interest to respond differently. Okay, so now I don't know. I can't tell you that. I measured the copper in some standards. And then I measured it in the samples, but it's different. It doesn't respond the same way. Okay, the response factor of the instrument, or however you want to think about it, is different in those kinds of systems. So migration turns out to be a bad thing almost universally in electrochemistry. Typically, the way we get rid of it is to add inert electrolyte. Now again, that can be a little bit tricky because if I have the four samples I think I just mentioned, distilled water, seawater, urine sample, and wastewater, those four samples, I'd have to somehow normalize the matrix. Or in other words, I would have to make them all have a very high salt content so that my analyte ion, the copper, would migrate, wouldn't really do any migrating, okay? It would be all of the other ions that are migrating. Now, what happens is when I apply a potential, everything that's charged migrates. Everything that is positively charged is being drawn to the negative electrode. And everything that is negatively charged is being drawn to the positive electrode. But if I have thousands of more ions of the inert electrolyte than my analyte, and typically that will be the case, then the amount that the analyte ion will migrate is very small or insignificant in comparison to everything else. And so that amount of migration is sort of diluted out, okay, by the addition of all of these other ions. So that's how we get rid of it. What's going on? Who's changing the slides? Okay. Is this the next slide? Oh, okay. Diffusion, migration. Okay, so we got rid of migration. Then we got diffusion. Diffusion. Movement of a species due to a concentration gradient. Can be an ion. Doesn't have to be an ion. Okay, it could be a neutral molecule. It's strictly concentration. It goes from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration to basically normalize the concentration. I talked to you about the little experiment with the dye. When we're all done, if we've allowed diffusion to occur, the dye concentration is equal in every part of the solution. Everywhere you look, everywhere you measure, the dye concentration is the same. So diffusion is very reproducible. Okay, it is dependent on the size of the ion and the solution, things about the solution, like basically the viscosity, okay, of the solution. Viscosity changes when you add anything to a solution. So if you take water and you add salt to it, it's actually its viscosity changes a little bit. If you take water and add ethanol to it, the viscosity changes, okay? Anytime you change the solution, the viscosity changes a little bit. That's going to change how rapidly, how quickly, how slowly an ion or molecule can diffuse through a solution, can move through the solution. And the size of the ion, okay? So if it's a big, giant ion with lots of... how do you get big, giant ions? Well, some ions, you look at the hydrated radius. Now you look at the hydrated radius of an ion. Some ions have a large hydration shell around them, and they're big. Okay, and they don't diffuse through the solution very quickly. Some ions are very small, compact, and will have a much higher diffusion coefficients. Who keeps doing that? So I talked to you about the idea in diffusion of concentration polarization. In electrochemistry, this is specific to our electrochemistry experiment. If I have an electrode, and I'm going to use this as my electrode, I'll use this. So I put it in my solution. I turn on the power, and immediately at the surface of the electrode, the layer of molecules or ions that are touching the surface of the electrode are immediately converted to something else. They immediately get reduced from an oxidized species to a reduced species. They go from iron 3 to iron 2. Well, that, like last class was iron class. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about chromium. Okay, they go from chromium 6 to chromium 3, or vice versa. If I have an oxidizing potential, I could oxidize chromium 3 ions to chromium 6 ions. So we immediately deplete the layer at the electrode surface. So in the beginning, before we turn the power on, let me go back to my favorite color, red. This analyte species is the same everywhere in the solution. Okay, we didn't do anything yet. And the product species is zero everywhere. We haven't generated any yet. We flip the power on, we flip the switch on, and electrochemistry happens. Doesn't really make noise. It's just for sound effects, okay? And immediately at the electrode surface, the concentration of A, which was high, drops to zero. Okay, those molecules, ions, right at the surface of the electrode, they're gone. They got immediately converted to the product. Once that's happened, Okay, in the instant, the first nanosecond. What's smaller than a nanosecond? A picosecond. What's smaller than a picosecond? A femtosecond. Okay, whatever second you want. Okay, it occurs and it's gone. Now, what happens in the next femtosecond, nanosecond, picosecond, whatever? The next layer of molecules are ions that aren't touching the electrode, but are right next to the layer that was touching the electrode and got converted to something else. That layer diffuses to the electrode surface. Why does it diffuse? Because the concentration of those ions or molecules is zero now at the electrode surface. So they move over, or some of them move over, based on the concept or the process of diffusion, and they diffuse in response to a concentration gradient, because the concentration is X at where they are, and it's zero at the electrode surface. So some of the molecules or ions diffuse to the electrode surface, they get immediately converted to product. It's A being converted to P in my example here. That process continues. The next layer begins to diffuse in, and things begin to diffuse from further and further away as a result of the concentration gradient that has been produced by my electrochemical experiment. After 1 millisecond, I mean, this is like forever compared to femtoseconds, picoseconds, and nanoseconds, then after 1 millisecond, the concentration polarization or the concentration gradient has extended out into the solution some distance, whatever this distance is, 10 millimeters times 10 to the third. So it's 10 microns. Okay, so it's extended 10 microns out into the solution, this depleted layer. It's not completely depleted, it's partially depleted away from the electrode. At the electrode surface, concentration is zero, it's completely depleted, but distances away from the electrode, it's partially depleted. Ultimately, we get out into what we call the bulk solution. In the 1 millisecond time frame, that's 10 microns away. If I wait longer, that concentration gradient extends further out into the solution because of diffusion and the electrochemical process, and the bulk solution, we wouldn't reach bulk solution until we were some further distance away. Usually we consider the bulk solution as some significant distance away from the electrode, because we don't know exactly what these distances are. In this experiment we do, but this is science fiction that I'm showing you right now. So this is a hypothetical case, not science fiction. Alright, so we get this concentration polarization and this gradient that develops for analyte species A the further we get away from the electrode. The converse, the case for the product, is also relevant. In other words, as product is formed at the electrode surface, and the product is zero in the bulk solution, then product diffuses away from the electrode. Okay, so it's diffusing, it's formed at the electrode surface and it's diffusing away because the rest of the solution is zero in terms of the concentration of the product P. And so it's diffusing, it's diffusing, it's diffusing. If we measure the concentration, we find it decreases as we go away from the electrode. And the longer we wait, okay, the greater this curve extends, this gradient extends out into the solution. That all makes sense to everybody? Okay. All right, so I'm beating a dead horse. All right. I just want to make sure you understand. Then we have our friend, Thick, a very fine fellow, who invented or created Thick's laws of diffusion. We could have called him, Thick's laws. Adolf Thick invented Thick's laws in 1855. This is chemistry trivia. And he was a mathematics kind of a guy, you know, a mathematician. And he figured out that do a thought experiment, okay, he probably was a disaster in the lab, you know, couldn't mix two things together without hurting himself. But he could use a pencil without damaging himself. And so he was able to come up with Thick's laws, and he decided that, okay, if I take a 1 centimeter squared area, okay, he had fingers, I guess, so he could make a 1 centimeter squared area. He said, I'll take this plane, 1 centimeter squared, and I'll suspend it in space. And I'll say, because of this concentration polarization idea that I have, low concentration, high concentration, in our case, zero concentration and high concentration, molecules or ions are going to diffuse through space. So I'll pick a spot, 1 centimeter square area, and I'll say there's a flux of material through that 1 centimeter square plane. And that flux is J. Okay, we'll just call it J, because it's a great letter in the alphabet. And the flux of material, moles passing a 1 centimeter squared plane at point X, at some distance from the electrode in our case, and some time T. Now, Fick's laws apply to all kinds of experiments in chemistry, in other fields of science. We're just applying it to electrochemistry here. If the material is going to diffuse or move, there is a diffusion coefficient, a constant, something that is intrinsic to that molecule based on its size, but also dependent on the solution. So if I have, what were we talking about before? Copper. Maybe today's copper day. So if we were doing copper ion in solution, then the copper ion has a diffusion coefficient, but it's different for distilled water, 0.1 molar sodium chloride, 1 molar potassium nitrate. The diffusion coefficient changes slightly. If I put it in acetonitrile, its diffusion coefficient might change dramatically. But it's different depending on the solution and the ion. You can look these things up. Okay, you can actually go to electrochemists that tabulated these things for common electrolytes, common solutions that are used for electrochemistry. You can look up copper 2 plus in 0.1 molar, you know, potassium nitrate. Oh, yeah, there's a tabular value for that, for the diffusion coefficient in centimeters squared per second. Fick's first law also includes concentration, and of course we mentioned time and distance, okay? This is basically steady state diffusion. Okay, we set up a system, we polarize the concentration by making it zero over here and high over here, or you could do it the cheap way. If you don't have an electrochemical instrument, you take a little Kim wipe and you throw some dye molecules in there and roll it up and throw it in a bottle of water. How come nobody brings like Poland Springs to class? Anyway, I need that. I need to use it for some of my demonstrations. So you put that stuff in there, you throw it in a bottle, and the stuff diffuses. Fick's law. Okay, Fick figured this out. Fick, our friend, figured out this whole process. So we put a 1 centimeter square plane, and those molecules are diffusing through it. All right, the plane is at some time in some time t from the beginning of the experiment, and it's at some distance x in our case from the electrode surface. All right, so this is steady state diffusion. We talked a little bit about adding to that or combining that with an expression for conservation of mass, and we can come up with Fick's second law. So the first law was steady state diffusion. So I picked a spot at some distance x, and we looked at the diffusion that's occurring with time, and now we're going to look at, this is non-steady, Fick's second law is non-steady state diffusion, and it is looking at the concentration with distance, basically, from the electrode in our case. We mentioned boundary conditions. Again, because we're talking, we're actually going to use both of Fick's laws in defining the whole system. Yeah, I'm just giving you sort of a cursory description of this, but I mentioned an initial condition where there is where T is equal to zero, where you are, the distance you are from the electrode is some, any distance, and the concentration C is equal to that initial concentration. So in my original diagram, it's this. Okay, that's my initial condition right there. It could also be the bottom one too, depending on whether we're talking products or analyte molecules. Then I said boundary conditions. What's the two extremes? Well, at one extreme, the concentration is zero. When is it zero? It's at zero at x equals to zero, So that's X. Right? So at the surface of the electrode, and at T other than zero, at T greater than zero. So the, at any time after I had flipped the switch on, the concentration at one boundary, the electrode surface, is zero. The concentration at the other boundary, where's the other boundary? Well, it's somewhere out there in the bulk solution. It's at distance infinity, okay, some great distance that therefore there is not, the diffusion process is not affecting it, and at some time greater than zero, okay, T greater than zero. Okay, so these are boundary conditions. We combine those with some electrochemistry, some, you know, Faraday's law, some understanding about the electrochemistry, and we end up with the Cottrell equation. Cottrell, he was an experimental type guy. He runs into Fick one day on the street. Fick says, I can tell you what's going on in your experiment. Cottrell says, great, I'll figure it out, put together an equation, name it after myself. You already got an equation, Fick. I need one, okay? And so he comes up with this equation and names it after himself. And it tells us, it's a basic fundamental equation in electrochemistry that defines all electrochemical methods, voltammetric methods, that are that involve diffusion. Okay, so with diffusion-controlled systems, it's the Cottrell equation. All right, diffusion-controlled systems, the Cottrell equation. It tells us that the flux, which Fick had defined as J, we're going to define as I. Sometimes I write it this way, sometimes I write it this way. It's still I, okay? It's current. And the current in the system is dependent on several things. Well, we know that it has to do with the number of electrons. If I have, the species is a two-electron system, it's going to give me twice as much current to produce, oh, let's see, yeah, twice as much current is going to be utilized, I guess that's the way to say it, is going to be utilized to convert copper, today's copper day, to, and let's say we're going to reduce copper, because copper only has one stable oxidation state in typical aqueous solutions. So we'll say copper 2 plus is going to be reduced to copper 0. In that experiment, the copper's plating out on the surface of the electrode, but don't tell anybody. All right, so the copper is being reduced. It takes two electrons to reduce the copper, and so N is equal to 2. So the amount of current is dependent on that N. It's also dependent on Faraday's constant, 96,500 coulombs per mole. Okay, so charge, okay, Avogadro's number of electrons basically is what we're supplying when we supply one Faraday. The area of the electrode, well, if it's a whole bunch of these ions lined up on the surface of the electrode, a big electrode is going to get more ions. A small electrode is going to get, and we're talking copper, so I said ions, copper 2 plus, it's going to be dependent on that electrode area. The concentration. If I have a big area of electrode and I only have, you know, five copper ions on it, that's only going to give me a little bit of current. If I have a big electrode area and 100 copper ions, I'm going to get more current as we convert the copper, reduce the copper 2 plus. It's going to depend, the amount of current that I get is going to depend on the diffusion coefficient. It happens to be a square root relationship. It's going to depend on how quickly we can continue to supply copper ions to the electrode surface to cause this conversion process to occur. You say, how does pi sneak in there? It's basically geometry. Right? If we looked at the derivation of the Cottrell equation, you would determine that it has to do with the geometry of the electrode surface compared with the bulk solution. And then we also have time in there because it depends. What happens with time? Actually, the signal drops off. The current drops off because initially there's lots of ions close to the electrode surface, but after I turn the power on for a while, I deplete the surface and it takes more time for the species to get to the electrode surface, so things are dropping off with time. So all of these components, we can rationalize how they affect the current. All right. So this is the Cottrell equation. I showed you this diagram last class, and I did my little experiment. I said, all right, I have an electrochemical cell. I put a couple of electrodes in there. I hook up a power supply to it, but I haven't pulled the switch yet. Okay. My power supply, let's say, has a dial on it. It allows me to change the voltage. Right? So I start out, I turn the switch on, but I have it at some very low voltage. Turns out it's at a voltage that's too low to convert copper ions, to reduce the copper ions that I've been talking about today. So, initially, even though the clock is ticking, I turned on the switch, but the voltage is very low, nothing is happening. Okay. Then all of a sudden, I jack up the voltage. I turn the voltage up high. Okay, it goes up. It goes up to a value that is a sufficient voltage to convert copper to copper metal. Okay, to cause that reduction to occur. And then I hold it at that voltage for a period of time. What's going on as far as the current is concerned? The system is consuming no current initially. Why? Because nothing was happening. I didn't have a sufficient voltage to cause the reduction of the copper. I got to the point where I jacked up the voltage and the current went zip right up. The current went up because all of a sudden I was converting those copper ions that were waiting at the electrode surface, just waiting to do something. I turned the voltage up to a value that is determined by the Nernst equation. Okay, it's determined by the Nernst equation because there's an E0 for copper. And if we could actually relate this to free energy, you could think of it as the energy that is required to cause the reduction of the copper ions. So all of a sudden I get a high amount of current, but that current drops off. Now, this part of the curve, okay, is the control equation part of the curve. This part of the curve, okay, I didn't draw that real well, but so this part of the curve is the part of the curve where the control equation actually applies. So if you're into like nonlinear regression or some esoteric mathematical technique, you could take the control equation and fit it to that line, make it fit, and you could determine some of the parameters that we're interested in. Now, in the experiment, you know a lot of the parameters. You typically know what N is. Don't always know what N is. Somebody could hand you a solution of an unknown compound and ask you to do electrochemistry on it. But typically, in analytical electrochemistry, someone gives you a sample and they say, analyze this. Okay, now, this is a favorite question for analytical chemists because people come to me all the time and they say, here, can you analyze this? You know, we're a state university, right? So people come from all over. They come out of the woods, okay? And they come and they say, here. One day, a person came here to the university, and they were holding a steak. They had just bought it at the butcher shop and said, can you analyze this? Okay, I want to know if there's something in it. There's something in it, okay? Analyze it, first question, for what? Okay, we got to know what we're analyzing for. So if we know what we're analyzing for, we typically will know N. Faraday's constant, is a constant. We may not know the diffusion coefficient, but we know it's constant. All right, it's constant for a given system. We may not know pi, but pi is still a constant. Okay. We may not know the concentration, but we can determine that by using standards or whatever. We can control the time. What else was in the control equation? I think I got most of them. The electrode area, fixed for our system. So these things are certainly constant. This is a constant. Pi is a constant. So the only things that are going to vary in the system are going to be the amount of current you get for a certain concentration for at a certain time. Everything else is, once you put the system together, you're stuck with it. Okay. Even the concentration, you're stuck with it, but you could change that. So the current drops off according to the Cottrell equation if we do the experiment and measure current versus time. So we're measuring current, that's I, versus time. Okay, and it tells us here that current drops off because material must diffuse to the electrode to replace that material that has been depleted. Whoa, that was fancy. Now, let me just mention to you that I threw this slide in completely at random because it tells us some of the electrochemical parameters that we have to deal with. We are already dealing with charge, although we won't talk about charge a lot. We will talk about it when we talk about Faraday's law But we're going to talk about a lot. So the charge, measured in coulombs. Current, which is measured in amps, or the ampere, okay? Current density, it's a concept you should think about. What the current is per square centimeter, in this case, per square meter, okay? Potential. All right, electrical potential is often given the symbol E. What's this, phi? I don't know, I never took Greek. And then V, it's measured in voltage, in volts, okay, or as voltage. But the symbol for the parameter versus the units is what I'm showing you here. Potential difference, or voltage difference is a delta, that's all. Just put a delta in front of those. Conductivity, we're not going to deal with. Resistance, okay, electrical resistance, the solution, the wires, everything has some resistance. Mobility, again, is probably related to conductivity. Charge number, Z, plus one, plus two, whole numbers, integers. It doesn't have a unit, right? Permittivity, we won't talk about. Capacitance, we will talk about. Flux density, we already talked about flux from the control equation. So these are some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Why I stuck that in there, I'm not really sure. But at any rate, why I stuck it in at that particular location. I've talked to you about migration, I've talked to you about the diffusion. We've got to break some new ground here and talk about convection. What happens when you stir or mix the solution? Well, convection is another form, is the third and final form of mass transfer or mass transport, and it's due to some kind of stirring, or maybe I should say mixing, and we got some kind of mechanical device to make the solution move. Now, we could stir the solution, or we could rotate or vibrate the electrode, okay, so if I'm moving my electrode, now they make vibrating electrodes. You can actually get a wire that moves. You can buy very elaborate rotating systems for electrodes, electrode rotators. We have one downstairs. They're expensive, fairly expensive. I mean, it's for the electrode, it's $1,000. For the one that I bought it years ago, it's $1,000 just for a motor to spin the electrode. It does that, we do that. Now, you can fill a stir ball in the bottom of the cell and spin it. That's okay, too. All of these things are done to move the solution. Because remember, the rate or the current is dependent on the rate of mass transfer. And if we can move the solution, we can increase the rate of mass transfer. So, convection gives you higher currents than diffusion. In migration, we don't want to do. So, diffusion, you just sit around and wait. And you wait for the things to move. In convection, you move the solution, stir the solution. Hey, only one I tell you. You move the solution, you make the ions or molecules move, and it gives you a greater current because you're moving more things. The rate is faster under convection. It's more efficient. However, it gives you poor reproducibility. Okay, it's not as reproducible. Think about this. You take a beaker and you put a stir bar, you know, a magnetic stir bar, a Teflon coated magnetic stir bar. Put it on a stir plate, spin it, and away it goes. And what happens? It spins nicely. Okay, and then every so often the stir bar goes. Blah, blah, blah. You ever see that? Okay, you like my imitation of a stir bar? Okay, every so often the stir bar goes a little crazy. It's not reproducible. Okay, and so we have a little bit of difficulty. Electrochemists make nice conical vessels that holds the stir bar in an exact location and spins it, so it's a little bit better, but still not as reproducible as diffusion, because diffusion doesn't depend on us. As long as we can keep them from driving those carts up and down the hallway, or you know, drilling into the wall with hammer drills, we can keep the solution fairly constant. All right. So if you have convection more efficient, then that would give you higher currents or greater analytical sensitivity. Okay. There is a concept, you know, scientists, they got too much time on their hands. So they decide to figure out, okay, we're going to figure out exactly how convection works. Convection works according to the concept that I'm about to describe you, referred to as the Nernst diffusion layer concept. Now, I thought we were talking about convection. Why is it a diffusion layer? It's a diffusion layer because no matter how much you stir the solution, there's always going to be a stagnant layer next to the electrode surface. All we care about is the electrode surface because that's where the action is. I tell people this example all the time. If you were in the streets of Boston, or Lowell for that matter, and the wind is whipping down the street, right, and you're out in the middle of the street, you're getting the full force of the wind. It's a convective system. If I want to get shelter from the wind, what do? I move towards a building. Okay? Why? Because the layers of air next to the building aren't moving as fast as they are out in the middle of the street. Why aren't they moving as fast next to the building? Because of frictional forces along the wall. The frictional force of the wind across the wall slows it down at the edge, at a surface like a building. So if I were to press myself up against the building, I would not feel the full force of the wind that I would if I were standing in the middle of the street. The same is true for our little electrode. Okay, back down to the electrode. So we got the electrode, we got stirring going on, but the molecules that are actually undergoing the electrochemistry are not feeling the full force of that stir bar that's banging around in the beaker, or whatever's going on in the system to cause convection. The molecules at the surface of the electrode are actually stagnant. Right? So what happens is, if I have my copper ions at my electrode surface, so a molecular layer there, or an ionic, a layer of ions right at the electrode surface, and I turn on the power and I convert those copper ions to copper metal, now there's no more copper ions, and I need to replace those copper ions, what happens is I'm stirring copper ions from the solution and they're coming right up close to the electrode surface, but there's a stagnant layer, that layer right up next to the electrode surface where nothing's really moving very fast, and the molecules or the ions at that layer must actually diffuse. They actually diffuse across that layer to get to the surface. So it's mixing out in the bulk solution and then diffusion in a very thin layer right next to the electrode surface or next to any surface. So this diagram says, what's going on out here? This is me in Boston traffic. No, this is the ions being stirred around, okay? So the copper is being all stirred up all over the place. This is my electrode, okay? This is the electrode surface right here. And then this is the layer over which those ions must diffuse, okay? So they're all this turbulent mixing going on out here in the bulk solution. It's crazy, right? Ions are flying everywhere. But when it comes right up to this little layer next to the electrode, things are very quiet there, very peaceful. Okay? And the ions must diffuse across that layer. We define that by delta, okay, some distance, all right, and we come up with a mathematical equation. Actually, I didn't give you the equation. Let me give you a diagram instead. So back to our experiment with A being an analyte molecule being converted to the product, A going to P, at the surface of the electrode. If the A is some constant concentration in the bulk solution, I stir away in the solution, it's constant solution, constant concentration, I turn the power on, and the concentration at the surface goes down probably to zero. Okay, they give you some other cases where it doesn't quite go to zero. I'm not going to deal with those until later, probably a few minutes from now. But so the concentration goes to zero, and then there's a gradient across that delta layer, okay, that Nernst diffusion layer, right? And the converse is true. If we're creating P, the product, it jumps to a high value at the electrode surface, it diffuses across that diffusion layer and then gets all mixed up into the bulk solution out here, mixing. Okay? Everybody cool with that? Let's move on. Oh, all I've told you is that here in this slide is that Fick's first law does apply to that stagnant layer. And if we talk about the change in concentration with distance across that layer at some time, basically that's what this diagram is, okay? The change in concentration across the distance, so it's concentration versus distance x at some fixed time. This is the snapshot of what's going on in the solution at some particular time. Then this is equal to the difference between the concentration at the surface and the concentration in the bulk solution. Well, the concentration at the surface might be zero. Right? Zero. So scribble that out and make it concentration in the bulk. And then we divide that by the distance of the thickness of the layer. So what's the average concentration in there? Well, it's the two extremes. Subtract the two extremes, get the difference, divide by the thickness of the layer, and that tells us what the stagnant layer is all about. Throw in the rest of our electrochemical equation, all right, NFAD, okay, and we have an equation for stirred solutions, okay? It doesn't have a name. I'm sorry. It's not a Cottrell equation. If you'd like, you can name it after yourself. It's up for grabs, this one, all right? Probably it's out on eBay. Yeah. Anyway, this equation defines electrochemistry in a stirred system. So Cottrell is a diffusion-controlled system. This equation is for a stirred system. Right. Just tells us what current is. And here I made it a lowercase I for no particular reason. All right, back to where I started last class, mass transport versus electrode kinetics. Let me remind you that this is what these two factors control the current. They basically control the current, or they control the rate of the reaction, which gives rise to the current. Okay, so experimentally, the rate of electron transfer is very fast for most processes. Why is that? Well, the reason it's sort of a dumb reason. The reason is, if I'm an electrochemist and you come to me and say, I would like you to measure. Let me think of something that's electrochemically inactive. I'd like you to measure sodium, okay, electrochemically. So you can't do it. Why not? That doesn't react. It's not electrochemically active. I can't reduce sodium ion to sodium metal in my electrochemical cell. Now, you can do it under pretty bizarre conditions, but I can't do it. Okay, I can't do it. So, what do you say? I cannot measure sodium electrochemically. I can't do it. All right. When it comes to all of the possible things that you can measure electrochemically, okay, by this voltmetric technique that we're talking about, there's a range of things that are electrochemically active. Many of them will react rapidly. Some of them will react slowly. So it says here, the rate of electron transfer, okay, one of the main things that dictates how fast this reaction is going to take place is fast for many processes that work. If it doesn't work, it's not happening, it's zero, it's not happening at all. So we're really sort of fixing the results by saying, we're only going to talk about the things that work. All the things that don't work, forget about them. Things that work, that are electrochemically active, the rate of electron transfer is pretty fast for many processes. The rate at which the electron jumps from the electrode to the ion to cause it to be reduced, because if we gain electrons, we undergo a reduction, or the oxidation process, the loss of an electron to the electrode, that transfer process is usually fast. But I should say, before I say that, if it's fast, the current depends only on the mass transfer. So we said originally there were two things that controlled the current, the kinetics and the mass transfer. If the kinetics are fast, then it only depends on the mass transfer. The kinetics are so fast that the electron transport reaction takes place in nanoseconds, and we are waiting around for the diffusion to tell us what the current is going to be. So current depends only on the mass transfer if the rate of the electron transfer is fast. And then it says, surface concentrations are in equilibrium with the applied potential as expressed by the Nernst equation. At the surface of the electrode, and I said to you a couple times already, that the Nernst equation still applies. It is the Nernst equation that is going to determine what the potential is, what the voltage is that we need to apply in order to cause the reaction to go. Some systems don't follow the Nernst equation quite readily. They typically are systems where the electrode kinetics are sluggish, where the electron doesn't travel quickly. The transfer from the electrode to the molecule, or from the molecule to the electrode, is sluggish. It's slow. It doesn't easily give up the electron, or doesn't easily accept an electron. Those systems are sluggish, and the Nernst equation doesn't turn out to apply properly. It's a non-ideal system, I guess you would call it, with respect to the Nernst equation. So we got a problem. Well, let me tell you first of all about the systems that are not a problem. Bless you. If it's not a problem, if the electrode kinetics are fast and things are in equilibrium according to the Nernst equation, then the system is called a reversible system. And you say, why do they call it a reversible system? This is a little quirky thing that electrochemists have done, and it's stuck. They did it centuries ago, a couple of centuries ago, and it's stuck. The idea that a system that meets the two criteria of fast electrode kinetics and follows the Nernst equation is called a reversible system. But isn't a reversible system something that goes forward and goes backwards? Not in electrochemistry. A reversible system is one that meets these two criteria. The current is dependent on the mass transport, and the surface concentrations are in equilibrium according to the Nernst equation. If it meets those two criteria, then it's a reversible system. That's the terminology. Please don't get confused. I don't know why I even ask. You will. A process can be reversible under one set of conditions and irreversible on another set. Well, obviously the opposite of reversible is irreversible. What's an irreversible system? One where the electrode kinetics are slow, sluggish, doesn't occur rapidly. A system where the potential applied is not in equilibrium with the concentrations. What do we have in the Nernst equation? E is on the left-hand side of the Nernst equation, and on the far right-hand side of the Nernst equation is a ratio of concentrations, right? Reduced over oxidized species. And all the stuff in between, well, E0 is in there, constant. RT, constant, constant. NF, constant, constant. Natural log, okay? So E is related to concentrations. If they are not properly related, if it doesn't follow the Nernst equation, it's an irreversible system. If it doesn't allow the electrode, if the electrons are not transferring rapidly like they should, it's an irreversible system. It turns out to be lousy for electrochemistry. It might still work, but it's lousy. It gives you lousy results. Okay. So a process can be reversible under one set of conditions. Okay, how can it be reversible under one set of conditions and irreversible under another? Under different conditions, I may get, think of the electrode kinetic part of it. At low temperatures, the kinetics may be slow. At high temperatures, the kinetics will speed up. So I might find that if I cool the system down, the electrode kinetics are slow and don't give me good results. If I heat the system up, electron transfer is very rapid, and everything's fine. Okay. Now, it's a rare case, but temperature, because of the narrow range, it's only 4 degrees C to what did I say, 40? I mean, typically that people might vary the system temperature over. But that's a possibility. It could be irreversible under the cold conditions and reversible under the warm conditions because of the electron transfer process. Process is more likely to be irreversible if it involves high current. All right. If you have a very high current system, you can't jam the electrons across the barrier between the phase barrier between the components in solution and the electrode surface. If it's a high current system, they can't transfer fast enough. They can't. There's a problem in forcing the current through the system that you've designed. So a process is more likely to be irreversible if it's a high current system. If I apply a rapid potential scan, remember how I jumped the potential in that little experiment I did? Well, if I jump the potential too fast, and I'm asking the system to respond, maybe the kinetics are such that it can't respond as fast as I want it to respond. The electrical engineers can design us a system that will change the potential 1,000 millivolts in a millisecond, right? I mean, we can instantaneously jump the potential. How would you follow that? You probably need an oscilloscope, okay? Because oscilloscopes are used for transient signals that occur on a very short time domain. Well, the time domain is important because that's where the kinetics are going on, right? And if the kinetics are slow and I'm rapidly changing the potential and they're not keeping up, it's an irreversible process. It's not going to be in equilibrium with the Nernst equation. The concentrations are not going to follow the Nernst equation because the potential is changing too rapidly. Okay? So that's the reversible electrochemical system. So a process is more likely to be irreversible if it involves a high current or employs a rapid potential scan. If a process is irreversible, then the rate of the reaction at the electrode surface will be slower than predicted from the mass transfer considerations alone. So, in other words, if I'm just worried about diffusion, okay, it's an irreversible system, it involves kinetics. We didn't even talk much about the kinetics or mathematically describing the kinetics. But if the kinetics are slow, then the mass transfer process, okay, is not the only thing controlling the current. So both things have to be considered. The best systems are the ones that have a fast electrode kinetics, and therefore I don't have to worry about the kinetics. I don't have, it's fast enough because transfer of ions, you think about it, right? Diffusion of an ion in a solution, that's kind of slow compared to the millisecond time frame that we typically associate with rates of reactions. So mass transfer is typically a slow process. Electrode kinetics is typically a fast process. If we run into a system that has bad kinetics, very slow kinetics, both things are major players in determining the current, and me predicting it, impossible. Right? There's just too many variables in the system. Okay. Very potentially linear. Okay, so I'm going to do an experiment for you. It's like the one we did before, but it's a step up. The first experiment that I did was I started at a potential where nothing was happening, and then I jumped the potential to a value where something was happening, and we saw the reaction. We saw the Cottrell equation. The current jumped up high and then dropped off with the Cottrell equation. That was the first baby experiment that we were doing for voltammetry. Okay, we're going to do this in baby steps. We're going to take little itty bitty baby steps and help you to understand. Now I'm going to do a little bit more complicated experiment. Instead of jumping the potential from a value where nothing happens to a value where something is happening, I'm going to slowly change the potential from a region where there's nothing occurring. It's not sufficient potential to cause the reaction to occur, to a potential where it is going to occur. Now, obviously, if I'm changing the potential slowly, over a range of potential values, ultimately I'm going to get to a value where the electrochemical reaction occurs. So that's what this is talking about. I'm going to vary the potential E linearly, E versus time. That's a straight line. Okay? It's supposed to be a straight line. So I'm going to vary the potential linearly, okay, with time, and I'm going to keep a stationary electrode, but it's a stirred solution. So there is convection going on in there. I'm moving things to the electrode surface as fast as I can. We're going to deal with it in terms of a reduction. Ox is going to go to red. Some oxidized species is going to go to a reduced species. All right, some whatever you want to put in there. The other day we were talking about iron 3 going to iron 2. Okay? All right? Whatever. Plug in whatever you want. Ox is going to red. I am, remember, in the background here, you can't see it, but E versus time is a linear ramp. I'm going to measure I versus the potential. I'm going to plot this same potential E. Okay? I'm going to plot E versus the current that is going to develop in my system. Why do I have I cathode, E cathode? Well, because this is a reduction. And remember the red cat? Okay? So it's a reduction. It takes place at the cathode. That's what we're interested in. Well, what's going on at the anode? Don't worry about it. Just relax. Don't worry about it. Okay? Nothing important. All we care about is what's going on at the cathode. Right? When we do electrochemistry, there's two electrodes. There's an anode and a cathode. But all I care about is what's going on at the cathode, because that is what my analyte, my species of interest, because I'm an analytical chemist and I'm doing electroanalytical chemistry, and I want to measure the species ox that's at the electrode, and it's going to be reduced to red, therefore it's a reduction process and my electrode is a cathode. Okay, so I start out down here somewhere, okay, and nothing is happening. Well, this is just like the other experiment. Nothing's happening. I have not reached a potential that is sufficient for the reaction to occur. So, la 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 la, nothing's happening, nothing's happening, nothing's happening. Okay? I eventually get to a region where I begin to see something occurring. Okay? I begin to see the electrochemical reaction occurring. I'm in the vicinity of the E0 for the species which we're calling ox, okay? Which is a fictitious species, but it could be pick something. I get in the vicinity of that E0, and then I begin to measure a current. The current begins to come up and up and up and up. Somewhere in here, I pass the E0, okay? And then I reach a point in the system where I come to a steady state where the stirring in my system, because remember I told you this was a stirred system, right? It was a stationary electrode, but I'm stirring the solution. I reach a point at which the supply of material to the electrode is a steady state, and I just get a steady state current that develops. Okay? Now, that's the general experiment. I'll go back and tear it apart. You say, wait a second. Nothing has happened. Nothing has happened. Why does it take off so slowly? Why isn't it that you just get to the E0 and boing, you get a current? Well, remember what the Nernst equation looks like. The Nernst equation is E, okay, equals E0, right? So that's the thing that is we're sort of shooting for. But that's going to dictate on this X scale the reaction occurs. But remember that there's a whole right hand side to the Nernst equation, minus RT over NF natural log of the ratio of red reduced over oxidized species. That whole right hand side of the Nernst equation is like a fudge factor for the E0. Okay, it says that as I convert ox to red, the potential E on the left hand side that I'm actually controlling, the potential at which the reaction is going to occur, at which the reaction is going to occur, is going to be dependent on the amount of ox and the amount of red in the solution. The E is not just the E0, but it's dependent on what the system is all about. And that has to do with free energy. You can basically, I don't want to make you sick, but this has to do with physical chemistry, and it has to do with the free energy of the solution and the chemical potential of the solution. And the chemical potential of the solution is changing as I change the concentrations in the system. So, as I change, as ox is produced a little bit, the E, if there's a little bit of ox in the solution, or excuse me, we start out with a lot of ox, and there's just a little bit of red. So as I produce a little bit of red in the solution, okay, the Fudge factor gives me a certain value that modifies the E0 that tells me what the E for the system is. As I produce some more red in the system, the ratio on the far right-hand side of the Nernst equation changes a little bit more, makes the Fudge factor a little bit different, and the E that I... the E at which the system responds is a little bit different. So the E is changing. So what I'm telling you is that this whole part of the Nernst this whole part of the curve is Nernst equation controlled. Right? It's controlled strictly by the Nernst equation and the potentials. You can stir till the cows come home, okay? Okay, you can stir, that's an old farmer's expression, because the cows eventually will come home. But you just keep stirring and stirring and stirring all day long, as long as you want. What difference does it make down here? In this region? Doesn't make any difference at all, because nothing's happening. When I get over to here, and I'm just converting a little bit of the stuff, it doesn't matter that much, because it's still... you know, it's the stagnant layer, whatever. So this whole region of the curve is really primarily Nernstian controlled. Okay, Nernstian controlled. Now, erase that. This part of the curve up here is mass transfer controlled. Because once I get to a value, what happens when I get to an E value, which is sufficient to convert any amount of ox to red? Okay, I've exceeded the Nernst equation, I set it aside. Every molecule, every ion of ox, or every molecule of ox, whatever it happens to be, that I drop into solution, okay, and it hits the electrode surface, is going to be converted to red. But it's only going to be converted to red if it hits the electrode surface. So the system becomes mass transfer controlled in this region. Now, there's overlap between those two regions. The region where there's mass transfer controlled and the region where the Nernst equation and mass transfer, there's overlap. There's an overlap in that area. But I want you to get the point. The point is, at some time, I've reached an E. Remember my curve. E versus T. At some point in time, I have reached a place where there is sufficient potential. If there's stuff there, it's going to get converted. Okay, it's going to, no matter what, whether there's one ion or billions and trillions and quadrillions and Googleplex. How big is that number? I forget. But anyway, it's a big number. Okay, no matter how many there are, it's going to be converted. Doesn't matter what the Nernst equation says, because we're way beyond the potentials where the Nernst equation applies down in here. Okay, so this is what's going on. Now, we just got done talking about reversible versus irreversible systems. Well, you know, reversible systems are ones where they obey the two criterion, the mass transfer, the electrokinetics were fast, and the concentrations were in equilibrium with the Nernst equation, or they were in equilibrium as defined by the Nernst equation. So this is a reversible process, gives you a nice sigmoidal shaped curve. The steepness of this curve is dependent on a little bit on the rate of scanning, the rate of this plot. Okay, E versus T. But it's primarily dependent on the fact that I've got some kind of a mass transfer process going on, and everything's just fine. Everything's in equilibrium with the inertia equation, electron transfer is fast, everything's good. So we have this nice sigmoidal-shaped curve. If I have an irreversible process, sluggish kinetics, I go to this potential, I go to potential here, and I should be getting a current like this, but I'm not. Why? Because the electrons need a bigger push to make them transfer. They're not following the Nernst equation. The E0 tells me, I plug it into the Nernst equation, tells me I ought to be seeing some significant conversion of ox to red at this particular potential, but I'm not seeing it. Okay? It actually, that amount of conversion, as noted by the current, doesn't happen until I go to much more higher potentials, greater reducing potentials. This is an irreversible process, and it gives me a drawn-out curve. If the curve is drawn out too much, it's useless. Okay, so some systems are irreversible to the point where we cannot do electrochemistry with them. They're no good. All right? Let me tell you that the difference, I didn't mention this term right here. The difference between where you should be and where you are for an irreversible system is the overvoltage or the overpotential. It's the extra potential that you have to apply to get the current that you're supposed to get. But you're not getting it because the electrode kinetics are sluggish. So that's what this says. Potential to achieve the same current as if the process was reversible. It's either called overpotential or overvoltage. A large overvoltage means the process is more irreversible. If it's a reversible process, the overpotential is zero. The overvoltage is zero. There is no overvoltage. The characteristics are the overvoltage increases with current density. Remember, I'm trying to jam too much current through there? Can't do it. It takes greater potential to get that current to work. It decreases with increasing temperature. Well, the kinetics get faster with increasing temperature, so of course it does. It's very high, the overvoltage is very high, for reactions that produce gaseous products. So, if I'm converting hydrogen ion to hydrogen gas, okay, there's a phase change. I'm going from the liquid solution to a gaseous state. That phase change, that process of converting a species in solution to a gaseous species generates high overpotentials, high overvoltages. Okay, it takes a little bit more energy than would be predicted by the Nernst equation alone. Some people think they can calculate or determine what those potentials should be for systems that produce gaseous products. Hydrogen's a good example. Oxygen's another good example. It depends on the electrode composition, the overvoltage does. So if I have, give a look I brought in a platinum electrode and I passed it around. I probably should have brought another one. But you look at it and you could actually see yourself in that electrode. You could see yourself, oh, geez. Handsome. And so you look at it, it's this reflective, polished, shiny surface. If you looked at it under an electron microscope, what would you see? Looks terrible. Looks like the surface of the moon. It's got pits in it, and craters, and cracks, and crevices. Okay? Well, that's what those molecules and ions in solution are seeing. They're not seeing your pretty face reflecting in the mirrored image or the mirrored surface of that electrode. They're seeing that rough surface down at the molecular layer, okay, molecular level, and it's rough, and it's dependent on oxidation. It's dependent on deposition of, you know, if I touched it with my finger, I got oils and stuff on there. If it's been exposed to the atmosphere, it's been oxidized. It's got adsorbed molecules. It's got gas molecules. It's got volatile species in the air that may adsorb to the surface. There's all sorts of things on that electrode surface. the composition of the electrode, whether it's gold or mercury or whatever, all those things, and I'm really combining numbers 4 and 5 here, it really depends on what the material of the electrode is and how it's been treated. Have you just polished it? Have you pre-treated the electrode by electrolyzing it and making the surface uniform? How finely did you polish it? How did you treat it chemically? Did you put it in a strong acid? Did you expose it to UV light? What did you do to the surface of the electrode prior to using it for this electrochemical reaction? The history of the electrode, or as it says here, very difficult to specify exactly what the electrode surface is going to look like at the molecular level and what the particular ion or molecule is going to see when it hits that surface. Okay, let me just mention quickly, in the huge amount of time that we have left, some other electrochemistry fundamentals. There are more than one kind of current. What we have been talking about so far is Faraday's current. Okay, Faraday's law tells us that, and we'll talk more about Faraday's law later, but that when a species is converted from ox to red or red to ox, there's an electron or two or three or whatever, how many electrons are utilized, and there's a relationship between the charge on an electron and the current that you produce in the system. Okay, that's what we're interested in. We're interested in the Faraday current. There's another kind of current, that's the bad current, the current from the dark side. Darth Vader, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. It's called capacitive current. It is a current that is generated in electrochemical systems because of the migration that we were talking about before. Because ions in solution migrate to the electrode surface and they build up in a layer. A positively charged electrode will build up negative ions at its surface. A negatively charged electrode will build up positive ions at its surface. And then there'll be layers of positive, negative ions that are built up at the electrode surface. This is like the charging of a capacitor. If you know anything about electronics, a capacitor is two plates separated by a dielectric, and you put a charge on those two plates, and it stores energy. Okay, stores energy, and in the old days, if you had an electronic system like a television set and they had capacitors in there and you turn the power off, unplug it from the wall and stick your finger in there, you'd get a zap. Why? Because the capacitors are charged up, right? And you could get they discharge when you stick your finger and touch the contact. So there is current that flows in electrochemical systems that is called capacitive current. It has absolutely nothing to do with an electrochemical reaction, with the oxidation or reduction reaction that we're interested in. Doesn't do anything. Doesn't tell us anything chemically. It's just ions migrating and building up. Even if they're inert electrolyte ions that we don't care about, it still creates a current. That current is a problem for electrochemists. And all of the electrochemical techniques, doesn't say this here, does it? Might say it on the next slide. Okay, if we change the electrode potential, current flows to carry the charge. So if I start out at some potential, some ions flow to the surface of the electrode, they migrate to the surface of the electrode, and then I change the potential to higher potential, more ions. Okay? So this capacitive current keeps changing throughout my system. It says here that it's significant in the neighborhood of 40 to 60 microfarads per square centimeter of electrode area. That number probably doesn't mean anything to you, but that's the kind of numbers we're dealing with. And if we're scanning, like we did before, E versus time, if we're changing the potential versus time, the capacitive current is always building. It's always building. And here's the problem. It's the major source of background. Or, in other words, it determines our detection limits. So if you want to determine the detection limit of an electrochemical method, and by the way, electrochemical methods have very, very low detection limits, okay? Very, very good ability to detect ions or molecules in electrochemical systems. But there's a problem. most modern electrochemistry is geared toward dealing with this problem. It's separating this non-ideal background error interfering current from the real thing that we're trying to measure, the Faradaic current. Okay, we're interested in the Faradaic current. We're interested in measuring the number of charges that are transferred because of ions or molecules of interest, but there's also current flowing that's due to just the charging up of the capacitor or the electrode as a capacitor. So what do? We have to do some fancy, tricky things to fool the system so that we don't measure all the capacitive current, but that we measure mostly Faradaic current and get a big signal, all right? And that's what electrochemistry is all about. All right, since we have lots of time left, let me just mention that there are several kinds of potentials, okay? We've talked already about junction potentials. We talked already about applying a potential to the electrochemical cell. Those are a couple of different things. But there's another potential. There's a potential in the system due to an IR drop. IR, I equals current, right? R equals resistance. So, in my electrochemical cell, I make a solution, I put some salt in it, I put two electrodes in it. Between those two electrodes, there's a resistance. There's an electrical resistance. I can take a meter and I can connect it, and I can actually measure the resistance between those two electrodes. When I do my electrochemical experiment, there's a current flowing in the system. The current is flowing all through my electronic system, and it's flowing through the solution. So there's a current flowing through a resistance. I times R equals V. This is basic electronics. Okay? Basic electronics. V, the voltage that's produced by a current flowing through a resistance, is another non-ideal or a voltage that's produced that doesn't have anything to do with the Nernst equation. It's just current flowing through a resistance. We have to concern ourselves with that. What do we do? How do we differentiate the voltage that develops in my electrochemical system because there's a current that I want to measure flowing through a resistance, and it's changing the potential that I'm applying. I'm applying a certain potential, and I think it's controlled, and I'm scanning it across some fixed values of what, but I'm creating a problem because I've got a current flowing through resistance, and that changes the potential. All right? There's three ways in which I can deal with that. I can work at very low currents so that I is very small, therefore V is very small. All right? So that might minimize V, that's the erroneous V, the V that comes from the current flow of the IR drop, and that might help me. So that's one good way to do it. So most of the time, electrochemists are dealing with microamps or nanoamps. We can measure picoamps. We can get ammeters, a picoammeter. You can buy a device that will measure picoamps. So if I work in the nanoamp or milliamp range, that's easy. That's a piece of cake. And that's small currents, and therefore it's going to generate a small voltage, and that may not interfere with my voltage that I'm applying. Secondly, I can minimize the R. The resistance, if the resistance is small, then the V is going to be small. So I got to make sure I got lots of electrolyte in the solution, that I'm not trying to measure I'm not trying to do electrochemistry in a system that has a very high resistance, doesn't have much salt in it, right? That's a potential problem. And then the third thing is, I could correct for the voltage that erroneous voltage in there by measuring R. So I measure that. So see, I make a single measurement of R because that's the resistance of the solution, and then I'm already measuring I. So basically, I measured R at the beginning of my experiment, and I'm measuring I throughout the experiment. So therefore, I could correct for V. You could do that, but it's hard because I is changing. And the R is constant, but I is constantly changing. So I have to be constantly correcting for something that's changing. So this is not normally done. However, I'm going to tell you later another way to do this, and I'm not going to tell you now. We're going to quit right now.